we exist? Were we created with a purpose, or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to the Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. This show is a ministry of the C.S. Lewis Society and supported by gifts of listeners just like you. Join us as we seek to see a generation captivated and transformed by the truth of Christianity. This is The Universe Next Door.
So today we're going to be continuing part two of our interview that we did with Dr. Stephen Meyer. We got into the Cambrian explosion, and which I think is actually one of the most convincing facts against Darwinism and for design. And so if you haven't checked out part one, make sure you go back and listen to that, because we're going to continue the talk about the Cambrian explosion, some common objections to it that do not stand. And then I had a few questions that I asked Dr. Meyer at the end, including what he thought of William Paley's watchmaker argument and a couple other things that I found really interesting. So it was a really fun interview. And then this upcoming week, we're going to have Dr. Michael Behe on. We're going to have an expert in epigenetics after that, before we wrap up this series on the doubts about Darwinism. And then we're going to be starting a series on cultural and ethical issues. It's going to be going from June, probably through July. We don't know yet, but so far we have some awesome guests coming on, some awesome topics. Basically, we're going to be discussing the most pressing cultural issues of our time, cultural and ethical issues. So if you have anything that you are having a difficult time answering, if there's any topic that you're like, man, if somebody brought this up, I wouldn't know what to say, go ahead and send an email to information@apologetics.org. with that topic, because we'd love to answer your questions throughout this series. We're going to kick the series off in a couple weeks with Sean McDowell, so it's going to be a really cool series, and the guests just keep getting better and better every week. So join us in discussing the difficult issues that not many people want to talk about. And with that being said, let's continue our Doubts About Darwinism series with Dr. Stephen Meyer. Famous paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould had come up with a concept called punctuated equilibrium, and this concept says that once a species appears in the fossil record, it continues on throughout most of its existence, undergoing little or no change in terms of evolution, which is referred to as stasis, and then this long period of stasis is quickly interrupted by a burst of change, which of course would be contrary to Darwin's idea of a slow and gradual process. Now, on one hand, this theory can provide the Darwinists with a response, with something to say to the Cambrian explosion, whether valid or not. And on the other hand, someone who denies Darwin may look at this theory and see it as just a way to explain away the problem of sudden appearance, and maybe even resemble magic or some sort of scapegoat to the issue. Now, does Gould's punctuated equilibrium offer a viable solution to the gaping issue of sudden appearance in the fossil record? Why or why not?
Gould proposed with Niles Eldredge the theory of punctuated equilibrium in the late 1970s, and it had a pretty good run for a while as an alternative to standard neo-Darwinism. But in the end, it had a great advantage, and in the end, a great deficit. The advantage was it did a better job of describing the fossil record, depicting the abrupt appearance of many groups of organisms, and then long periods of stasis in which the basic form of the organism changed very little. So that was a plus for the theory. The downside was he proposed a mechanism known as species selection, which in the end depended upon good old-fashioned natural selection acting on random variation. It was a mechanism to account for larger bursts of change in short periods of time, but on its own, there was no biological basis for it, and so in the end, he had to repair to a reliance on the same mechanism that the neo-Darwinists had used. And so by the 1990s, I think interest in or support for punctuated equilibrium began to wane. And I've got a whole chapter on this in Darwin's Doubt, and to kind of tell the story of the rise and fall of this particular approach. It's not a hot idea anymore.
Sure. Well, that's a great answer, and I think that's very helpful, because I'm still surprised to see it sometimes used, probably not by reputable biologists, but by common people. I hear it brought up here and there.
Well, it caught on because it was a nice, as I said, it was provided a more accurate description of the fossil record. But the problem was it really had no mechanism for accounting for the abrupt appearance of the change that is observed in the fossil record.
Sure, sure. Now, you had mentioned the trilobite. This is a creature that I'm fascinated by and always have been since learning about it. And my birth is coming up next month. If anyone wants to mail me a trilobite fossil, you can ship that. I'm just kidding. But what is so unique about the trilobite's anatomy? What is it that makes it such a unique creature and something that stands out in the Cambrian era?
Hold on just a second, Nick. I'll show you a picture.
There we go.
My publisher kindly put an embossed trilobite on the the cover of my last book, Darwin's Doubt. So it's actually, you can feel it.
It's a great cover, by the way.
You've got the trilobite has these three separate lobes, so trilobite. It's got, one of the things I think is fascinating is that it's an arthropod. It's got a hard exoskeleton. And one of the things I think is fascinating about the organism is that it had compound eyes of the kind that we find in insects today. And I have a fossil at my office where you can actually see the cones of the eyes. And so we have really definitive evidence of a very sophisticated anatomical feature from the dawn of animal life. Remember, in the most basic schema, Darwin's idea is that you move from simple to complex over time. And what we find in even the first animals that have appeared on life or appeared on Earth is evidence of very sophisticated anatomical structures, very complex, as complex as a modern insect eye. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a fascinating thing about trilobites. There are many others. There's lots of different species. And they preserve very well because they had this hard carapace or exoskeleton that they would shed. And so we get a nice imprint of what the animal looked like. And one animal could probably shed, maybe a dozen or more over its lifetime, but certainly more than one. And so we have they're very well represented in the Cambrian record.
Now, you also touched on, you just kind of touched on it again, but earlier you had mentioned the human eye in the design of the human eye. Now, I've heard it said many times by Dawkins, of course, all the way back in the 80s that his book was written. Now, I've heard him and many others mentioned that the eye is poorly designed if it's designed, and it's evidence of the evolutionary process opposed to evidence for a designer. What should we think of that?
There's been a number of really good papers refuting that idea. The eye manifests a feature that engineers describe as constrained optimization. And what often happens with evolutionary biologists who jump to the conclusion that something is poorly designed is that they end up looking at one feature of a system, not thinking about all the engineering trade-offs that have to be accomplished in order to make the system function well overall. The vertebrate retina, which is the object of their critique, has visual acuity that is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, an eagle eye is a vertebrate retina, and so what you see in the eye is not a badly designed thing, but a system that is balancing competing design requirements in an elegant trade-off. So one of the first papers on this, Michael Denton has written on this, a biologist named George Ayoub has written on this. And if you like, we can put some paper, we can send you some links that you can put up on your website for people who want to investigate in more detail.
That would be great. I saw something pretty interesting written by Jonathan Wells recently, too, on the human eye. Now, I wanted to ask you a couple questions. These are just things I find incredibly interesting. They are kind of on topic with what we're talking about, but they're definitely on topic in biology in general. My first question is, if the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA and all that came with it in the 1950s would have been made in the 1850s, do you think, just in your personal opinion, this would have made Darwin think differently about his theory?
I think it all depends on the extent to which Darwin himself was committed to this principle of methodological naturalism. He certainly alludes to it or affirms it in tacitly, but maybe he would have thought differently if confronted with the evidence that we now have. In the 1860s, in the immediate wake of Darwin's, the publication of Darwin's theory, the famous his famous bulldog, Thomas Henry Huxley, described the cell as a simple homogeneous globule of undifferentiated protoplasm. The concept of the simplest form of life at the time was that it was very simple, that it was just an enclosure with a bunch of goo inside. They had no idea that inside cells were miniature nanomachines and a complex chemical factory and a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system. That rivals, and it doesn't just rival, it exceeds the complexity of our own digital high technology that we have developed in the computer realm. But irrespective of that, those speculations, I think the evidence that we have of the information-bearing properties of DNA do in fact point to a designing intelligence. And the argument for that, I think, is fairly straightforward. In 1953, Watson Crick elucidated the structure of DNA. In 57, Crick realized that he hypothesized that the chemical subunits along the interior of the helix, known as the bases or the nucleotide bases, are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written text or like the zeros and ones in a section of software, which is to say, it's not the chemical properties of those individual subunits, their weight or their shape that gives them their function, but rather their arrangement in accord with a code, which was later discovered and which is now known as the genetic code. So by the mid-1960s, the molecular biologists realized that inside living organisms, there was a genetic text that was being expressed by a genuine code. And then that information was being processed to produce the proteins and protein machines that keep cells alive. It's a fascinating system of information storage and transmission and processing. Now, in our experience, in our universal and repeated experience, which, as you alluded to before, is the basis of all scientific reasoning, information always comes from an intelligent source, whether we're talking about a paragraph in a book or a section of computer code or a hieroglyphic inscription or information embedded in a radio signal. If you trace information in a digital or alphabetic form back to its source, you always come to a mind, not a material process. So I've argued in Signature in the Cell, my first book, which concerned the origin of the first life, but also in Darwin's Doubt, which concerned the origin of animal life, that the big bursts of information that we see coming into the biosphere are evidence of the activity of a designing mind.
So intelligent design isn't just some sort of theory that popped up out of nowhere. This is really based on the standard human experience that everything we know that is something that contains information comes from a design or a designer.
Absolutely. This one of the kind of prime movers in the intelligent design movement was a man named Charles Thaxton, who wrote a book with two co-authors, Walter Bradley and Roger Olson, in the 1980s called The Mystery of Life's Origin. And this was this book critiqued all current theories of the chemical origin of life. But in an epilogue, they said, there's a deeper problem here than just getting the chemistry to work. It's getting the chemistry to create code, to get it to create information. And that gap in our experience between chemistry and code has always and only been filled by intelligence. So they suggested that perhaps we were looking at evidence of an intelligent cause. I ended up doing my PhD thesis on the methods of reasoning we use to reconstruct what happens in the remote past in order to explore the question of whether or not a scientific case for that intuition could be made. And that's eventually what I argued in Signature in the Cell, that there is a strong scientific basis for the inference to intelligent design, precisely because our uniform and repeated experience, again, the basis of all scientific reasoning, affirms that information always comes from an intelligent source. Now, in the book, I qualify that by telling how much information and what kind of information we're talking about. But and sure. I also look at competing explanations that have been proposed for the origin of information and show that they're inadequate. So it's a hefty book. It's 500 pages. But the basic idea, I think, is intuitive to most people. to explain the origin of a program, you need a programmer. To explain the origin of information generally, you need an intelligent source.
Now, another place that those opposing intelligent design often go is what's referred to as junk DNA. Now, is junk DNA called junk because there's no use for it and it's taking up space, or is there an opposing view to this?
Well, it was called junk DNA because it was thought that it had no function. And in the early 1980s, it was discovered that big sections of the genome were not involved in coding for proteins and providing the informational instructions for directing the production of proteins. And as much as 97% of the genome may well be non-coding DNA. But in the 90s and early 2000s, soon after this was discovered, many committed neo-Darwinists said, aha, that's the evidence of the random trial and error process of natural selection churning out failed trials next to the mutations that were beneficial and were selected. So that's what we would expect. We'd expect, they said, to see a lot of flotsam and jetsam and junk left over from this random trial and error process. On the other side, in the 90s and early 2000s, proponents of intelligent design said, well, hey, wait, not so fast. We're going to make a different prediction. We accept that mutations are real processes. But on our theory, we wouldn't expect that the signal would be so dwarfed by the noise, that there would be a 97-3 type of ratio. And so we suspect that non-coding region, those non-coding regions of the genome, are going to be importantly functional. And there were a number of scientists, Dean Kenyon, Forrest Mims, William Dembski, and most importantly, Richard Sternberg, who predicted that the non-coding regions would turn out to be functional. And Sternberg, in studies in bioinformatics and genomics, began to discover hidden function. But then even more dramatically, in 2011, the ENCODE project was published, which was an extensive bioinformatical study of those non-coding regions of the genome. And it was determined that virtually all of that non-coding information is transcribed. It produces something, either regulatory RNAs or other important functional molecules, and that it was in fact functional. And that overall, the non-coding regions of the DNA function something like an operating system in a computer that control the timing and expression of the other information, the data files. And so what you actually have there is evidence of a hierarchically organized system of information processing. So far from being evidence of the genome being less complex, less sophisticated in its design, actually what we've discovered is that it's much more complex than we realized. And yeah, that we jumped prematurely to a conclusion based on Darwinian theory, whereas the ID perspective generated a correct prediction about what the non-coding regions actually are.
Now, that's what it certainly sounds like. And my last question for you, just before we kind of wrap this up, is that the intelligent design movement is often referred to as pseudoscience. Now, for those of us who have kept up with ID, we know this is sort of, in my opinion, more of a baseless accusation than anything else. But what do you say to this?
Well, it's a bit of a badge of honor, actually. Just it's the way the other side tries to negate our arguments without engaging them.
Right, and I've noticed that a lot of times they're just personal attacks. And even on your new book, on your website, you have comments from both those in support of your book and who aren't in support of it, such as Lawrence Krauss.
Well, Krauss isn't in support of the book, but he did inadvertently say something nice about me, so we put it up there just to. Probably not fair, but we did it anyway. The pseudoscience accusation is merely a reflection of people's commitment to methodological naturalism. And if methodological naturalism is a good and correct canon of method for science, then it's a fair insult. But we don't think it is, and here's why. we think that science should be open to the scientists use a method, especially historical scientists, use a method called inference to the best explanation. And one of the things I showed in Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt is that the case for intelligent design is built using the same method of reasoning that Darwin himself used in The Origin of Species, a method known as multiple competing hypotheses or inference to the best explanation. And so if you want to say that intelligent design is not science by definition, you would, by the same logic, have to say the same thing of Darwinism and other evolutionary theories, which use the same scientific method. It's a different method. It's characteristic of people investigating questions about what happened a long time ago. It's an historical scientific method. Stephen Jay Gould described it as inferring history from its results. It's a different type of science. But usually what people mean when they accuse ID people of being pseudoscientists is that they're violating this convention of only materialistic explanations. But if we're dealing with an historical question, we argue that it's important to be open to the idea of a designing intelligence playing a role in the events that you're examining. Why? Because it's one of the possible causes that could have been at work. You're looking for the best causal explanation of events in the past a long time ago. When we think about the origin of the first life, it might have been the result of unguided, undirected, and purely materialistic processes. That's a possibility. But it's also a possibility that a mind played a role. There may have been a mind that pre-existed or that existed prior to life on this planet. And therefore, we've got to be open to the possibility, and we should let the evidence decide. Now, what kind of evidence could decide that question? Imagine you're walking into the British Museum, and you look at the Rosetta Stone, and you see those etchings in those three different styles of etchings on the rock. Well, when the archaeologists first discovered that, they didn't say, gee, this must have been wind and erosion. Instead, they recognized right away that these were linguistic systems. There were hieroglyphs, there were other kinds of writing, and they realized that those informational sequences were a product of mind, because we know from our uniform and repeated experience that it takes a mind to generate information. So they didn't infer a purely materialistic explanation. They inferred the activity of a designing intelligence. In other words, there are certain types of evidences that definitively indicate the activity of intelligent agency. And if we find those in the natural world, as well as in the realm of human artifacts, we need to be open to the possibility that those natural systems were the product of intelligence. So we're arguing for an open philosophy of science, or an open method of science, that allows us to consider all possible causal explanations for events in the remote past, not just materialistic explanations that may or may not have the support of the evidence.
And that sort of touches on William Paley's watchmaker argument. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, it's often dismissed as an argument from analogy, but isn't it actually an argument of inference to best explanation using an analogy?
No, I actually think it is an argument from analogy, and that's one of the things that made it weaker than the modern design argument. I discussed that in I think chapter 17 of Signature in the Cell. It's not a bad argument, because it's an argument from analogy, but it's not as strong as it can be. And what we show is that we're arguing not from arguments from analogy argue to similar causes from similar kinds of effects. The problem with arguments from analogy is if you were unable to precisely quantify how similar the effects are, it's difficult to quantify how similar the inferred cause is to the known cause of the other effect. What we do in developing the case for intelligent design is not argue from similar effects, but rather posit the best explanation of an identical kind of effect, both in computer code, in written language, and in DNA. And that effect is information, but information of a very particular kind called specified information or specified complexity. And that gets a little technical, but it can be understood fairly readily by reference to some common experience. If you have a series of characters, gibberish, just monkey at a typewriter, there's a definable amount of what's called Shannon information in that sequence, but it has no function, or it's not, the characters aren't arranged specifically to perform a function. If above that I write a line of poetry, time and tide wait for no man, is an example I've used, there's a qualitative difference between those two types of information. The top is functional, and because the arrangement of characters are specific to perform a function in accord with an independent symbol convention or code. And when we find that kind of information in even very modest amounts, we can infer with confidence that a mind played a role. And that's what we do find in DNA. So we call that kind of information specified information or functional information or specified complexity. And that's the effect of interest in making an inference to design. And it's the same effect that we find in computer code or written language or other types of human artifacts. And we also find that in DNA uniquely. And so it justifies this strong inference to design, not based on analogy, but as an inference to the best explanation.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And obviously it has and is continuing to make a huge impact. Now, where can we go to learn more about Dr. Stephen Meyer and to support your work?
Well, I have a book website for the new book called returnofthegodhypothesis.com. And the previous book, darwinsdoubt.com. And I've got lots of debates and articles and updates about the books and various content on there. Animations of these miniature machines. We've got a whole playlist of these fascinating animations. An animation of how the DNA directs the construction of the proteins, as we've been talking about. So I think if people are into this discussion, I think they'll find a lot of interest on those websites. Returnofthegodhypothesis.com and darwinsdoubt.com.
Now, for those listening to over the podcast, those will be in the description below. Well, Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door. I'm sure that this episode has given you a lot to think about, and we'd like to hear what you're thinking about it at information@apologetics.org. So send any questions you may have or comments. We love to engage with the community that takes the time to listen to the show, and please share The Universe Next Door podcast with a friend. Well, thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door, and we'll see you back here.